Welcome to another in the teaching series of Dr. Ken Boa, President of Reflections Ministries and Trinity House Publishers. His talk today is part 8 of A Biblical View of Work. Here to begin his study is our teacher, Dr. Ken Boa.
We have been describing how in our thinking, a biblical perspective on our thought should tell us that work has changed as a consequence of the fall, and that the fall and the character of work have really affected one another. Work was something that was ordained by God at the very beginning, but now, as a consequence of the fall, the character of work was changed in such a way that it was associated more with toil than with joy. And that's why a couple of weeks ago I showed you this cartoon here that you'll all remember. Remember that again? From what does that look like?
Hi-ho.
Hi-ho, hi-ho. You know, and if I had to go to that place every morning and found freshly cut gems sticking halfway out, that all I have to do is pluck from the surface of the walls. What a man you
You're
are.
Ready.
Thank you, Steve. You're great. Now I can wake up. If I were going there, I'd say, hi-ho, hi-ho, it's off to work I go as well, you know. Wouldn't it be great if work were that simple? If you could just go there and it's just waiting for you to pick it. But we know that that's different. It's going to be by the sweat of your brow. It's going to be by toil and by labor and by endeavor that you will work. And that you will have a recalcitrant environment. It'll resist your efforts to tame it, to subdue it, to order it, to control it. It will constantly resist what you're trying to do. And therefore, more energy will be required. There'll be more toil, more frustration. The image of thorns and thistles is a significant one because it implies that prior to that, it would not have been very difficult, relatively speaking, to cultivate the garden. Again, a task they were given prior to the fall, not after. So the work itself is good, but the shape of the work, the nature of the work has changed. And one imagines what might it have been like if, in fact, that did not take place, the fall did not take place. I imagine that there would be a fecundity and a beauty and a joy that would be associated with that, where things would cooperate and there would be a genuine order. And one of those alienations that took place as a consequence of the fall, besides the alienation between ourselves and God, which was the spiritual death, and the day you eat thereof, you will surely die. And that was indeed in that very day, that was spiritual death. The physical death would follow. But it was also the alienation, recall, from within, so that man was separated from himself, and now we have this inner pull. And then we had the third alienation. The consequence of that inward alienation was our alienation with our neighbor, a social alienation. What's the fourth alienation? Besides God, ourselves, and others, there's a fourth fundamental alienation. What would that be? The creation itself. The creation itself, we were now separated in a very real way. The earth had to be cursed, because if the earth were not cursed, we would not have been, a fallen man would have not have been able to have dominion over an unfallen creation. So in effect, the world now is waiting for its redemption. It's waiting for its day of redemption. And in Romans chapter 8, it's subjected to futility. And this is a significant concept where it describes how the whole creation groans and suffers the pains of childbirth together until now. It even says before that that the anxious longing of the creation waits eagerly for the revealing of the sons of God. The creation was subjected to futility, that is to say, to disorder, to chaos, to randomness. Not willingly, but because of him who subjected it, that God himself subjected the created order. In hope that the creation itself also will be set free from its slavery to corruption into the freedom of the glory of the children of God. And so the redemption of nature will be associated with our own redemption. And in our resurrection, when we are glorified, then God will ultimately resurrect, as it were, the created order, and it'll be brought, and he will make all things new. So it's an image that we can see here that we anticipate, but right now we are still called to work in this context. And we see as well that not only did the fall affect the character of work, but also we see that work can become a source of idolatry. That the reality is that it can become an end in itself rather than just a means to an end. It can become something that we live for. And a man can become a workaholic because it becomes his home, his basis of identity. If you turn with me to Ecclesiastes, the wisdom literature of the Old Testament. And of course, this is after Psalms and Proverbs, pretty easy to find. If you go to chapter 2, you see Koheleth, which is the name for the preacher, wrestling with a number of issues. He begins by talking about the apparent vanity, the foolishness, the emptiness. And he basically says that things are not the way they were meant to be, that things are changed, and it is vanity of vanities. Haval havalim, he says. It is, in fact, evanescent, empty, and things seem to go in cycles, and it seems to have no real redemption. And then he gives mixed signals about the nature of work. Listen to chapter 4, 2, verses 4 to 11. I enlarge my works, he writes. I built houses for myself. I planted vineyards for myself. I made gardens and parks for myself. And I planted in them all kinds of fruit trees. I made ponds of water for myself from which to irrigate a forest of growing trees. I bought male and female slaves. I had homeborn slaves, and I also possessed flocks and herds larger than all who preceded me in Jerusalem. Also, I collected for myself silver and gold and the treasure of kings and provinces. I provided for myself male and female singers and the pleasures of men, many concubines. Then I became great and increased more than all who preceded me in Jerusalem. My wisdom also stood by me. All that my eyes desired, I did not refuse them. I did not withhold my heart from any pleasure, for my heart was pleased because of all my labor. And this was my reward for all my labor. Thus I considered all my activities, which my hands had done, and the labor which I had exerted. And then listen to his words. And behold, all was vanity, futility, haval, and striving after wind, since there was no profit under the sun. Now that's an interesting collection of verses, is it not? What did he achieve? And my own view is that Koheleth comports best with Solomon. I have no problem with Solomon having written this, and certainly would fit with his lifestyle and what he was able to achieve because he was unprecedented. The man was not speaking out of sour grapes. The guy was speaking out of the reality of abundance. He had prosperity, he had opportunity, he had power that we can hardly even imagine relative to his culture. He was exceedingly wealthy. And he considers his activities, but then what does he conclude? He says it was all vanity, striving after wind. There was no profit under the sun. And then he goes on to say, and by the way, I should mention, he pursued a lot of things. What are some of the things he pursued? There are a lot of W's. He pursued wealth and attained that. Women, he got that. What else did he? Give me some other W's he got. What? Wine. He was big on wine. He got a lot of wine, okay. So he got wealth and women and wine. Wisdom. He got wisdom. Tremendous amount of wisdom. Your work. Work itself. He enlarged his works, you see. And so you have all of, and another one was wit, because he was very interested in not just wisdom, but wit. So here's a man who amassed so much that it dazzles the imagination as to what it would have been like. In his days, silver was regarded as worthless. It was everything was embellished and enriched and beautiful in his day. And so this is why the Queen of Sheba, you recall the story of how she goes up to behold Jerusalem and she is overwhelmed. She says, the half was not told me. You exceed in wisdom and in power all that the rumor had said. And generally, rumor mills exaggerate reality. In this case, the reality couldn't keep up with the rumor couldn't keep up with the reality. She was away, amazed. In fact, she went away blessing the Lord God, and she said, "How blessed are your people who hear your wisdom continually. And how blessed is your nation that the Lord your God would be the one who would set such a man to be your king." That was the way, by the way, it was meant to be. And indeed, if Israel had retained fidelity to God as a theocratic covenant community, I believe it would have continued with that level of prosperity and abundance. That was God's intention for them. Indeed, in the old covenant, the fruit of the vine was related to blessing. In the new covenant, that is not the case. Last time I checked, righteousness didn't always lead to being well off financially and physically. And unrighteousness didn't always lead to the opposite. The reality is then that now it's more the fruit of the Spirit, not the fruit of the vine, contrary to the prosperity gospel that would want us to think of the other way around. The reality is, though, that here's a man who attained all these things and it was still not enough. He goes on in his meditation in verse 18. "Thus I hated all the fruit of my labor for which I had labored under the sun. For I must leave it to the man who will come after me." An interesting thought when you think about it. I mean, we all know what that's like, succession and so forth. A man builds and amasses wealth, and then what often happens, we hear it again and again, that it's frittered away, squandered by people who have no sense of the value or what was involved in creating that wealth. And who knows whether he will be a wise man or a fool. "Yet he will have control over all the fruit of my labor, for which I have labored by acting wisely under the sun." This, too, is vanity. I can't control where it's going to go after I'm gone. That's what he's really saying. I amassed this, but what's going to happen? He was wise enough to know that though I may own this material on a deed of purchase or all of that, I don't own anything because I'll leave it all behind. Again, that's why the old phrase, you never see a U-Haul behind a hearse. Because you can't take it with you, you see. That's the reality of it. This too, he says, is vanity. "Therefore, I completely despaired of all the fruit of my labor for which I had labored under the sun. When there is a man who has labored with wisdom, knowledge, and skill, then he gives his legacy to one who has not labored with them. This too is vanity and a great evil." The man's being very realistic, as you can see, being brutally honest. In fact, in my view, Ecclesiastes is the most contemporary book of the Bible in the sense of its contemporary relevance. It speaks and addresses to and addresses issues we all struggle with in our own time. "For what does a man get in all his labor and in his striving with which he labors under the sun, because all his days his task is painful and grievous? Even at night his mind does not rest." This too is vanity. Any of you, I'm sure none of you have done this, go to sleep worrying about a deal or worrying about what's going to happen or worrying where your future is going to be going. No one I know in this group does that. You see, he's saying even when you're flourishing, your mind can't get it out of it. You're constantly consumed if you're not careful. It can rule you. And this is why he says those things. Now turn to the text I have up there on Luke, and Luke 12:16-22, a very familiar text because it invites us to see something in many ways very, very similar. In Luke 12, he told them a parable, saying, "The land of a rich man was very productive, and he began reasoning to himself, saying, 'What shall I do since I have no place to store my crops?' Then he said, 'This is what I will do. I will tear down my barns and build larger ones, and there I will store all my grain and all my goods. And I will say to my soul,'" I like how he says, "soul, you have many goods laid up for years to come." I always like that phrase. "I says to myself," self, I says, "soul, you have many goods laid up for yourself. Take your ease. Eat, drink, and be merry." But God said to him, "You fool, this very night your soul is required of you. Now who will own what you have prepared?" Does that sound familiar? Who will own what you have prepared? Precisely what Koheleth was just saying. Who will own what you will leave behind. You cannot take it with you. So is the man who stores up treasure for himself, he says, and is not rich toward God. And he said to his disciples, "For this reason I say to you, do not worry about your life as to what you will eat, nor for your body as to what you will put on." Because he goes on to say life is more than those things, which is similar to what he says in the Sermon on the Mount in chapter 6, Matthew 6. The point is, he's saying here, is that you have to understand that God well knows that you were wired to pursue profit. You were wired to pursue gain. And you will be frustrated if you, in fact, amass wealth that others will take away. This is why Jesus made it very, very clear. Go with me to Matthew chapter 6 and again be reminded of that text where he invites us to have wisdom concerning wealth. And by the way, wealth is not in itself a bad thing. It's how we think about it and what we do with it. It can be a very good thing. And that is something that we have to explore together, that God can give us wealth. But if the more he gives us, the more, in fact, he's entrusting to us. And therefore, when we say, "God bless my business," maybe a better way of putting it is, "God increase my responsibility." That's probably a better way of looking at that, because he's now given me more to which I will be accountable. Another way of looking at it. At any rate, when you consider, when he says, "No man can serve two masters, you'll either hate the one or love the other," in Matthew 6:24, he'll be devoted to one or despise the other. You cannot serve them both. They cannot both be your supreme master. And he says, don't be worried about these kinds of things, about what you'll eat, what you'll wear, and so forth. Life is more than those kinds of things. This is why he says that earlier on in the text, in verse 19, do not store up for yourselves treasures on earth where moth and rust destroy. In other words, it can be corroded, it can be corrupted, where thieves can break in and steal, where any of those things that are unstable. No, understand that you will amass treasure. He says this very clear. Where your treasure is, what does he then say? This is where your heart will be also. And so he says then, you need to understand that I am not opposed to amassing wealth in the best sense of the word. If you pursue that which will endure, man's life is more than his possessions. And he says very clearly then, what will a man give in exchange for his life? And so if I evaluate my life, the wise man will say, I will give my life in exchange for something. Will you not? You can't help but exchange your life for something. Make sure, Jesus says, that what you give your life in exchange for is something that will endure, that will not wear out, that will not be corrupted, that will not fade away, but that's something that will be actually that which endures, that lasts. That's again why Psalm 90, verse 17 tells us, establish, give permanence to the work of our hands. Yes, confirm the work of our hands. We want the work of our hands to continue. But if our work is based only on that which is tangible and material and is not done for the King, it will ultimately dissipate and others will take it, and who knows what they will do with it. Comments or questions on that? Because that's just pure wisdom to me when I compare that with what Jesus then does with that and embellishes that. And you know Jesus knew the book of Ecclesiastes, and he's picking up on some of those themes. Any thoughts on that?
How long did he reign for?
Solomon reigned for 40 years. Yeah. And he had... Usually the tradition is that he wrote the Psalms, especially when he was younger, that he wrote the Song of Solomon when he was younger, in his middle years, the Psalms, and then his older years, Ecclesiastes, as a tradition. Proverbs in his middle years? Yeah. Psalms in his younger years. Proverbs and Ecclesiastes is usually associated with his older years, as a man looks back and says, what was all that about? You know, and one of the things that we do is we wait too long to reflect backwards. Usually we wait till near the end of the journey of life, and then we look and say, what was that about? Might be smarter to think in advance, before you get there. That's what Jesus is telling us to do. Think in advance. Always live with the end in mind. And allow the future to determine then the journey. Let the destination determine the actual journey itself. And also be wise enough to recalibrate on a regular basis. Recalibrate, which means revisit that destination. Is that still where you want your life to add up to? Why do you want it to look like that? If you do want it to look like that, what's the price? What mid-course adjustments need to be made now that'll affect my life 5 years from now? Those are the kinds of questions I want to be asking now. Because you see, what I'm doing now will affect what I am 5 years from now. But wouldn't it be wiser to recalibrate on a consistent and regular basis my day, my life, so that I can envision it in light of eternity, in light of what God has for me in this life, and then seeing that in light of eternity. My friend Bill Garrison died a number of years ago, but he was a wonderful thinker, and he had a couple phrases I always like to use, and you've probably heard me quote them before. He says, "What are you taking under your arm to the ultimate show and tell?" And I always like that image. What are you taking under your arm to the ultimate show and tell? What is he asking there? Here's another way he puts it. He says, write your obituary and ask, will it play well in heaven? You see, what he's asking in those two questions is, allow the destination to determine the journey. And if I write my obituary now, how will it play before the Bema, the judgment seat of Christ? Isn't that a smart way to live? It seems to me to be smart, because if I'm not doing that, I'm going to kind of stumble along life. And I will be ruled by activities and agendas of others. And I really won't be intentional, but I'll really be a person who kind of just gets bumped around and becoming what my activities kind of move me into. Instead of discovering purpose from top down, I'll kind of back into purpose by allowing my activities to determine my objectives and then backload a purpose statement based upon what I find myself doing. And it's much wiser for me to really anticipate, and that's what I'm suggesting here.
What are a couple of the ways that you see that we justify
Yeah, Tom is asking how do you justify this issue? Work. We all struggle with work being what we do determines who we are. Effectively, isn't that what our culture, our world tells us, that you are what you do? Isn't that pretty much the message? And if you're not careful, you will really weigh your worth, your value, in terms of your accomplishments, and that's a very dangerous thing to do, because then it's very unstable. It doesn't provide a stable basis for identity. You have a comment on that?
How do you separate when you do work and you pledge it to the Lord, if you get some pleasure out of what you do?
Yeah, especially when what you do is gratifying, it's hard not to get caught up in it. May I stress that I'm not denigrating doing. I'm simply saying that the doing, though, doesn't define you. That's all I'm saying. Because if you're what you accomplish, and then you have some kind of a metric, some kind of a benchmark, if that's going to define you, what happens if you do not attain it? You see, this is the issue. What happens if your career goes south, if your deal sours, if you lose your job? What happens then? You see, if you are what you do, now what are you? What happens when you retire? Those are all questions we need to ask. And I'm suggesting then that we are more than what we do. I'm suggesting that a biblical mindset tells us that we are the ones who are called to shape our work, not the other way around. That we bring an identity to our work, and then what we do flows out of who we are and whose we are. If we have it that way, then I think that it can be more satisfying. And that's why I say, and many, many times, and you'll hear me say this again and again, that our fundamental call is to be faithful to the process that God has called us to, and then look to Him for the outcome. I cannot control the outcome. And this is one of the dangers we have, is men want to control and count and manipulate, and we can't always do that. We can't really be in control. We suppose we can, but we cannot control. So the wise course, then, is to do your best work. Do it as unto the Lord. Do it with skill, but I've got to look to God for the outcome. But I also must not allow the thing that I do or the what I have to define me. I must allow Him to define me. Otherwise, what I'm going to say, when it becomes an end in itself, when it becomes your modus operandi and becomes the thing that defines you, it will be idolatrous. That's what I'm saying. So the way we overcome that idolatry is actually doing all things as unto the Lord and seeing our true identity and our source of significance and satisfaction coming from Him. That's why I'll again argue, as we will a little bit later, that you don't go to work just to earn a living. Actually, you don't go to work to gain significance. Instead, you actually do these things as an expression of the image of God in you. It's an arena of influence, and God's the one who will provide your significance, and God's the one who will provide for your wealth. And that is why I said before, do not look to customers and clients as your source of provision. They may be a means that He may use, but they are not your source. And that, yes?
There's an integrity also involved in the work itself, in that we must be sure that our work in itself is something that would be pleasing.
It is a question of integrity. And the integrity is something that I have to live. The phrase is coram Deo, before the heart of God. The whole idea is, as I stand before God's face and heart, how does that play out? So integrity will be animated, especially if I see that God really is always there. Now, we have an amazing ability to be practical atheists throughout the course of the day. Am I correct? You can pretty well plan and make your decisions and talk with people and so forth, and God hardly even comes to the surface of your consciousness. Am I mistaken here? I don't think I am. It's easy to do that. So our job, in part, is to seek to develop skill at welcoming them into the routines of life and the way my conversation and the decisions that I make. Integrity will always be a part of that. This is why a man without accountability will not have that much integrity. And accountability is needed both before God and before other men as well, which we'll talk about a little bit later. So it can be two extremes. It can be idolatrous. The other extreme is the other problem along with work, a biblical perspective, again, is brutally realistic here. It's realistic. One of the things I love about the scriptures is it tells us what human nature is really about. It's not naive. And that naivete of human toward human nature really propels a lot of foolish ideas that really do not take human nature into account. And it's just, but whereas the scriptures give us a brutally honest assessment of human nature, but it's capable of doing that precisely because it also tells us that in spite of our depravity, we still have dignity. Only the gospel gives you both. You see the idea? If you do not have the good news of the gospel, I don't think you'd be able to really plumb the depths of human nature and come out of that with your sanity. I think you would become cynical. You might despair. But the scriptures give us a picture that though there is this depravity and this selfishness and so forth and exploitation, nevertheless, having been created in the image of God, we have dignity and we have possibility of redemption. But work can become and will become a means of exploitation and oppression. The Exodus text, as you can see there in chapter 1, is in fact reminiscent of the story of Joseph when it says what? There was a new Pharaoh. What does it say about him? Who didn't know Joseph? Who's this guy? And who are these people who are multiplying in our land? We better control them. And so they put them under a yoke of slavery. And for 400 years, they are under that bondage and exploitation. In Shawshank Redemption, most of you, I bet, have seen that film probably more than once. Am I correct? It's still the IMDb number one film. IMDb, Internet Movie Database, is the ultimate movie database, and it's the number one rated movie there. When I teach that film and others, I sometimes ask, why is that? What does it speak to? Why does it speak to? It speaks about hope is one thing and a variety of other themes. It somehow touches us deeply about relationships, about friendship, about hope, about purpose, about being institutionalized, about being ruled by this world, about becoming prisoners even when you're not in a prison, and about people who are imprisoned who are not necessarily imprisoned. You see the concept there? And being institutionalized is a frightful thing. You get used to these walls, and after a while you need them. And the prison is like a metaphor of the world itself. We can be institutionalized by the world and its system, you see? So even though we're free, we're maybe under bondage. And there's a great moment there where near the end of the film, when his judgment cometh, and that right soon, as the warden looks at that thing and the cops are coming after him there, and there's no action. Then the Daily Bugle, you know, which is an image of the judgment of God then. And then he grabs that Bible, he discovers that he's been hoodwinked and that he opens it up. You're right. You're right, Warden. Salvation lies within. And then he opens it up and finds the pickaxe that was hidden in that Bible all along. But what most people don't notice is where it was located. Turns out that the pickaxe is located in Exodus chapter 1. That is not accidental, I promise you that. Why is it located in Exodus 1? Because it's symbolism of slavery, of oppression, of bondage. You see the imagery there? This is not an accident. So next time you see it, I promise you, you'll be looking at that and you'll find I'm right. I'm not making this stuff up. But it is a means of exploitation and of oppression. And if we consider this, look at James 5:4 in the New Testament perspective as well, where James tells us that there is a very real danger. Again, the brutal honesty and realism of the Scriptures. It knows what human nature is like. Behold, it says, the pay of the laborers who mowed your fields and which has been withheld by you cries out against you, and the outcry of those who did the harvesting has reached the ears of the Lord of Sabaoth. And so his point here is that God does hear the cry of the oppressed, and ultimately there will be a payday. And that whole idea of payday someday, that's one of the most famous sermons ever preached. If you just Google payday someday, or go to YouTube and look that up, very interesting sermon to hear. At any rate, God is not mocked. And ultimately, there will be justice, but in his time and in his way. But right now, work itself, which can be a good thing, can be a means of exploitation and abuse. But then you have this idea, though, we're called to work hard in Scripture, but we're called not to work, to overwork. You see, the sluggard is this tragic comic character. He's both funny and he's tragic. There's a lot of funny verses about the sluggard, but then when you think about the humor, it's really pretty pathetic. And he's reproached in both the Old and in the New Testaments. I mean, if you look at Proverbs chapter 6, for example, and verse 6 to 11. So we have the two extremes. On the one hand, don't become a workaholic. On the other hand, don't be a sluggard. Now, my belief is that the sermons that different audiences need are going to be different according to the audience. This audience probably doesn't need the sluggard sermon. You need the workaholic sermon, I'm suspecting. Most of you probably, or if you're going to be skewed one way or the other, you're probably skewed toward activism rather than just in sloth. I may be wrong here. Maybe some of you are slugs. I just love the image. But if you go to Proverbs chapter 6, you slug. I just love that word. Proverbs chapter 6. Verses 6 to 11, it tells us, go to the ant, O sluggard, observe her ways and be wise, which having no chief officer or ruler prepares her food in the summer, gathers her provision in the harvest. How long will you lie down, O sluggard? When will you arise from your sleep? And then you hear the sluggard say, A little sleep, a little slumber, a little folding of the hands to rest. Your poverty will come in like a vagabond, and your need like an armed man. And I just love that way in which the sluggard rationalizes. What does it say? A lot of sleep, a lot of slumber? What does it say? A lot of folding of the hands to rest? What does it say? A little, a little, a little. And that's, if you've, and I've given this to you 20 times, you won't remember it, but Derek Kidner's great statement based upon this proverb is, he says, a little, a little, a little, and thus we deceive ourselves by the smallness of our surrenders. The deception is because he rationalizes and says, is it not a little? And this is how a man can deceive himself, by saying it was a small little thing. It was not much. And then each small compromise makes the next one possible. So that we don't really fall in terms of just sudden falls, but rather they are slow leaks, not blowouts. It is not a big compromise. He has rationalized his own script because he says it's a small thing. It's just a little bit. That's what he's saying. Have you ever done this when you say it's just a small thing? And so we compromise and we rationalize. We do this all the time. And so we have to have this perspective here. Then he says, here's what the consequences. Your poverty will come in like a vagabond, your need like an armed man. Or if you consider chapter 12, verse 27 in Proverbs, another word about this sluggard. And there he says, a lazy man does not roast his prey. The precious possession of a man is diligence. The guy's too lazy even to roast his prey. 13:4, he says, the soul of the sluggard craves and gets nothing. The soul of the diligent is made fat. Chapter 20 in verse 4, there's a whole series we have of these things. The sluggard doesn't plow after the autumn, so he begs during the harvest and has nothing. He doesn't go through the effort. Then he wonders why he doesn't have anything, and so forth. And in the New Testament, by the way, and there are other verses, 2 Thessalonians chapter 3, verse 6 to 12, Paul had to address similar problems. And he speaks about the fact that in verse 6, keep away from every brother who leads an unruly life, not according to the tradition which you received from us. For you yourselves know how you ought to follow our example, because we didn't act in an undisciplined manner among you, nor did we eat anyone's bread without paying for it. With labor and hardship we kept working night and day, that we might not be a burden to you. But then he goes on to say, if any man is not willing to work, verse 10, then he is not to eat either. That's an interesting phrase. It's not saying if he can't work. He says if he's not willing to work. You see the idea there? That the idea would be that if you're not careful, you will go and err in one of two directions. Either you will so value work that what you do determines who you are, or you will so avoid it that you basically are believing that somehow it'll just be there for you, or that others will take care of you, or whatever it might be. You'll have this naive mindset. And I think that the scriptures give us a more balanced orientation along these lines. So when work becomes the source of our significance and security, we swing to the opposite extreme and become consumed by our work. I basically want to leave you with this concept that there are two extremes to be avoided. In the one hand, if it's the source of your significance and security, you will be consumed. If, on the other hand, you just think that you can just kind of get away with a minimum effort, and that somehow people owe you, that's the opposite extreme. So people can slip into one or the other. And I fear that, generally speaking, the people that I minister to, the kind of people that I generally find myself working with, will tend to the extreme of letting their work define them, tend to the extreme of letting their work become their source of significance and security. And therefore, when things fall or when things crumble, then they go through a crisis. If, on the other hand, you grasp who and whose you are, and you grasp that your security and significance come directly from God, He may mediate that through these other things. I'm not denying that it'll be painful, but it doesn't have to destroy me psychologically when things are not going the way I would like. Now there, what'll happen, though, it'll be an opportunity for me to learn to grow in trust. You see, that's what's going to happen there. And he'll teach me insights I didn't have otherwise. Joe?
Could it be that overwork is when your work does become the source of your significance and security? For example, I bet you work all the time.
Mm-hmm.
But I think rarely does your work take on significance and security.
No, yeah, I do. Karen complains that she thinks I work all the time, but actually I'm playing most of the time. What I mean is this: what I do is what I'd do if I were independently wealthy. This is true. I love what I do, and so what I do. What do I love to do? I love to create. So when I tell people what I do, what do I tell them? I've told you this many times. There are four things. What are they? Oh, that really came across very well. Yeah, that really. You don't even have one of them. I tell people that I'm a writer, a speaker, a teacher, and a mentor. Well, all four of those are creative activities. You see, each one of them has its own kind of a feel. Some of them are local. Some of them are the writing and the speaking are out of town or have broader influence. But the point is, each of those has its own area of creativity. Bill Gibson and I create visual presentations. I'm always creating new things. I love to do that because it amuses me. But it also edifies me, and I hope it will edify other people too. This is why I also do things that are really strange, like creating a whole presentation on the world according to the Far Side. Why do I do that? Because I enjoy that. I have 4 gigabytes of humor in my humor folder. 4 gigabytes of this stuff, of every description, of videos and audios and text and visual presentations and so forth. I have a whole thing. I created the world according to the Marx Brothers. When they're good, they're very good. When they're bad, they're awful. So I figured, okay, let's take their very best. In some cases, in some of their movies, there was very little to be found. But having said that, I then pasted this together. I got one fabulous hour's worth of stuff from all their movies. Why did I do this? Because it was fun. And sometimes I'll use it and drop it in to illustrate. See, having created this, then I have the creative ability then to drop it in at a moment's notice in any presentation I want. You see, it gives me power to do that stuff. So Karen complains about that. My big complaint is this. I, as a creative person, I'm a total intuitive. I hate being in the sensory mode. And I have a lot of sensory things that I'm forced to do that are mundane and ordinary. That's work for me. And I hate, that's the negative part of it. And I don't like doing that. Yeah. Robert, yes.
Yeah, I do executive and professional service in my second career now. And I think I'm really good at telling whether somebody loves or is passionate about what they're doing or it's just a job. And I think that you can only sustain excellent performance if you love what you do. My question then is, can we let him define our work? Or in other words, our avocation, can that be our vocation?
Mm-hmm. Yes, that's where I'm going with this idea is letting God define what I'm called. My calling relates to my career. I claim that your calling, remember we said this before, vocare, what does that mean? Calling, Latin word for calling, which we've reduced to vocation. Vocation used to mean a good deal more. Do you have a vocation? Was more than your job, but now it's been reduced to that. I claim that your calling transcends your career and your jobs that you have within your career. That you have a calling that transcends the seasons and circumstances of life, that you'll live into this calling. And that the calling is not just something static, but you grow in apprehension of what that looks like. And a person may have various careers, but one ultimate calling that's getting exploited and developed. And therefore, there can be a pleasure in that process of discovery. And who knows where that's going to go? But I tell people that your best years should be the ones ahead. That you should see that all this other has really enveloped your life into a process that can equip you for your next career or your next part of life. Never retire from life. Never retire. You may retire from a particular career, but never from life and from ministry. You must always see it this way. And I'm simply saying, and this is where we'll close, is that I must never let, though, the things that I do become the source or wellspring of my identity or significance. In other words, God must be the source of those things. Then I'm free to enjoy them, even if the outcome isn't what I had in mind. You see the idea? But if instead they're the source of my identity, then the outcome will shape me. Instead, I want God to shape and define the outcome. And when I do that, it gives me a bit of margin and a little distance. And I'm distant enough from the thing that it doesn't have to then cause me to be driven by those things. Remember the difference between a man who is driven and a man who is called. And we don't want to be driven men, but men who are called. And therein lies, I think, a huge difference. One last question, we'll...
I've been showing what a post-student I am, but are you going to, somewhere in this series, explicitly give us some perspective on how much is enough?
Yeah, we'll talk about that, yeah. It's a very good... we'll close with this thought. He's asking the question, how much is enough? And this is a question very few men ever ask. How much would be enough in terms of money, but also how much is enough in terms of the time that I spend at work? Do I have am I spending so much time that it's taking away from significant activities or significant relationships, you see? So I have to ask those tough questions. Otherwise, it's a moving target.
Thank you for listening to this talk, which is part of a series of messages by Dr. Ken Boa. To order additional talks on CD or MP3, or to learn about any of Dr. Boa's other Bible-based teachings, go to our web ministry at kenboa.org. That's kenboa.org. Or call 1-800-DRAW-NEAR. That's 1-800-372-9632.